Today, titanium squared. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hello, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How have you been?
Pretty good. A lot going on at the moment.
Well, there most certainly is.
And I guess what we'd like to do is perhaps explore a little bit of the sets of issues around ScoMo, what he said over the last 24, 48 hours, and specifically the poll that came out today, which basically suggests the titanium shielding is still working.
Oh, it certainly looks that way. I mean, things could have been a whole lot worse for Scott Morrison. A lot of people were thinking, you know, this could be the beginning of the end, but, you know, the titanium shield holds.
So why do you think that is?
I think that there's generally a fatigue. They call it disaster fatigue amongst people. And when you have a sequence of difficult events like natural disasters for a protracted period, people just tend to become sort of desensitized to it. And they're just still sort of like, oh, I just don't really want to think about the fires anymore. I mean, from a political sense, obviously, you know, people are still very, very interested in an emotional perspective, from a practical perspective. But politically, it's just like, well, there's not really, no one's really putting forward all that much of an alternative at this point. So it's not really all that different. I think it's more just the fact that the alternatives are weak, really. You know, Labor isn't really polling all that well. I mean, ScoMo personally looks awful. You know, like this is one of the biggest single hits to a net approval rating in a long time. But in terms of two-party preferred, he looks remarkably good. One point away from 50-50. Mm. And after his, you know, sort of global hit to his popularity, it's surprising that he's actually polling this well.
Yes, it's interesting because, of course, the international reporting has been relatively negative. But I think you're right about the fatigue and the fact that people are beginning to try and say, well, you know, what are the things that we need to do in the short term to perhaps help to fix some of the short-term issues? And, you know, let's be honest, the $2 billion plus which he's now talking about spending is going to definitely be stimulatory to the economy in the medium term. And in a way, it gets him out of jail in terms of, you know, the surplus is now less sacrosanct than it was. So it does lay a platform potentially for him to pull a rabbit out of a hat.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for the moment, you know, like the sort of $2 billion is the headline, but I think from what I've read, it's only going to be about $500 million this financial year. So sort of that keeps the promise of surplus somewhat intact. And I think as we get closer and closer to the budget, as we head towards the sort of third and fourth week of April and the budget starts leaking, which it inevitably does, I think we could really start to see some really quite sizable stimulus flowing through, because there is that going to be that opportunity for them to just go, bang, you know, we're going to spend this on reconstruction. We're going to spend this on infrastructure. We're going to spend it on all these different things. But it gives him a rather huge opening. You know, he now has the opportunity to do that.
Mm. And of course, that may take a little pressure off the RBA, because the RBA for the last year or so has been basically saying to the government, spend more, you know, put some fiscal stimulus into the system. And the government resisted because they wanted to protect the surplus. So in a way, the shifting of the sands now allows the government to put a bit more money in, and maybe the Reserve Bank will then say, well, if you're going to do that, then we'll just monitor to see what happens. We won't cut in February.
Yeah, I think that there's still going to be a fairly sort of serious impetus to cut in February. You know, I mean, I'm not an economist, I'm not a data analyst, I'm just a journo who just sort of, you know, watches the way the chips fall. But, you know, I think that they're going to be looking for some short-term insurance. You know, I mean, we just had that brief report from ANZ today saying that credit card spending over the Christmas period was down something over 5%, which is not exactly a positive result, given that last year we had an increase in credit card spending and retail sales still deteriorated. So I think that they're going to be looking for some insurance there, and just to sort of shift the focus back onto the fiscal side rather than, you know, the focus being solely on the monetary side as we've been seeing over maybe the last six months or so.
Well, certainly the retail figures that came out just last week, you know, had a little bit of a spike around Black Friday. But actually, if you look at the real data, it remains very, very weak. And certainly my own survey information that's coming through now suggests that people didn't spend over the Christmas New Year period. So I would expect very weak retail sales for December. The confidence measures I'm also seeing are very weak as well. So that's taken another hit. And that's both in terms of personal finance confidence levels, but also the broader economy confidence levels. They're both lower. So it may well be that the Reserve Bank will need to cut in February simply to sort of keep the ship afloat, as it were. Doesn't leave much for later, though, if we have a crisis.
No, I think that it's cheap insurance for the future. Like because there's no guarantee what Morrison's going to do. There's no guarantee that Frydenberg's going to change his tune and we're going to see a big shift in the government's attitude towards, you know, sort of fiscal stimulus. But I think that for the RBA, they really sort of want to avoid being caught flat-footed. Because if we do see a big deterioration in the economy, if we do see a big deterioration as a result of the fires, the construction bust, and all these various things coming together at the wrong time, then I think it really could be quite important that they at least are seen to be doing something, even though the effect of the interest rate cuts in the real economy hasn't really been all that positive.
It is quite interesting is that the tenor of the surveys that, you know, that I see at the moment, it is very much around, well, we're really not seeing anything by way of income growth. The cost of living are continuing to be a significant drag, a significant pressure. But interestingly, the cuts to interest rates have not been seen as a positive move. So it hasn't really given huge impetus to people to go spend more. It's being seen as a flag to say the economy is much weaker than people were saying. And I'd also make the point that, you know, the RBA has actually been on the back foot for at least a year, maybe 2 years, because they've been forecasting growth a whole lot stronger than it's been. They've been forecasting wages growth a whole lot faster than it's been. And slowly they've had to trim their expectations back and back and back. But of course, the RBA and Treasury are still way more bullish than most of the other economists who are looking at the data. And we wonder whether they'll actually have further shocks ahead as a result.
Absolutely. I think that the RBA has been caught behind the curve many, many times recently, unfortunately, for everyone, really. It's just a case of they give these lovely, lovely V-shaped curves in wages growth, these lovely V-shaped curves in, you know, inflation that sort of is going to spur all this, you know, this fantastic situation for us. But it's not happening. And I think that they're really quite concerned about that happening again, you know, about them being caught flat-footed again. And especially because this time there isn't, you know, someone who's more accommodative in power. And this isn't Kevin Rudd. This isn't, you know, sort of, you know, Wayne Swan or Malcolm Turnbull, who's still going to be willing to sort of go, okay, this is, you've presented me with the problem. Let's talk about coming to a solution. This is a far more ideologically driven sort of stimulus. Like surplus. But I'm not entirely certain if we are going to see that turnaround yet, because I would have thought that given the enormous political cover that the Morrison government has been offered by the bushfires, by the downturn, by all these different things going on around the world, you know, whether it's Iran, whether it's, you know, the trade war, there is absolutely enormous opportunity for them to just go, forget about the surplus, forget about it, you know? You know, we need to protect the economy, we need to protect jobs, and they can just go back to, you know, that their favorite slogan from the 2016 election, jobs and growth, jobs and growth, jobs and growth, and then it repeated infinitum, as they usually do.
Well, it's very interesting. The data that's coming out as to the total cost of the bushfires is pretty interesting, right? So, you know, you've got Westpac saying, well, about $5 billion. You've got AMP saying maybe 10 or 11 billion. My own estimates over 3 years were 30 billion. And there was AccuWeather who came out with 100 billion overnight. So, you know, the numbers are getting bigger.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the thing is that we really don't know. I mean, we have all these different estimates. I mean, and, you know, like, there's quite a sizable difference between 3 billion and 12 or 30 or 100. But we really, we don't know what the impact's going to be. You know, a lot of these disaster impact studies into the economy, you see them and it's like, oh, okay, this disaster is going to has cost $3 billion. So like the Queensland floods, you know, that impact, economic impact kept getting, the impact studies just kept on going up and up and up and up. And even years after the fact, you know, 3-4 years when academics finally start researching it in detail, you start seeing that these things revised up by, you know, $2 or $3 billion at a time. And we really don't know what's going to happen, especially because this is such an unprecedented event affecting such a large area. You know, like tourism's been hit, you know, some mines have been hit. All these different industries have been hit in different ways, you know, farming and agriculture especially. And we just don't know exactly where the chips are going to fall.
Yeah, and the issue there with tourism is quite interesting because that's one of the things I've been looking at in some detail. It's not just the immediate, you know, people can't go down to the South Coast over Christmas, New Year, but it's the international images that are going around the world of the bushfires, the smog. That can change the trajectory of tourism for a generation, actually. You know, this could be a big deal, not just over 1 or 2 years, but actually into the medium term. And because we are so reliant, I think tourism is something like our fourth largest earner, if you look at it in the round. That could be a very significant impact.
Most certainly. And I think that's what's really key. Like people, Australians look at the fires and they go, oh, well, you know, yeah, they're bad, but sort of they're not affecting the entire country. But, you know, there was that map released by ABC News US that showed basically the entire coast on fire, including some of the interior. And people don't know. People don't understand, you know, how big Australia is. You know, they don't understand that, you know, Queensland is bigger than Texas, you know. But so there is this sort of disconnect between what they're seeing on TV and reality, like you're saying. And that could really just affect these attitudes, because people are saying, oh, you know, I don't want to go to the coast in Australia because there might be fires. And it's like, well, there's all these other, you know, coastal areas in Queensland, WA and the Northern Territory, you know, that are absolutely unaffected and there's no threat of fires at the moment. But that's not really helping, because people don't understand that. I mean, some people overseas, they think that you can drive from one side of the country to the other in a day, you know. So they don't really understand the scope of things, you know. And to hear that sort of, I think it's up to about 10 million hectares total over this fire season from when it started earlier in 2019 has been burned. And they hear that and they hear it's bigger. I think the Wall Street Journal said it's bigger than West Virginia. And the, you know, people are going to look at that and they're going to go, oh, wow, you know, the whole country must be on fire. You know, we better not go there.
Mm. Well, it is very interesting. And, you know, nobody knows exactly what the cost will be. The bushfires in Victoria a decade ago, like Saturday, right, the Royal Commission came out with a number of 4.4 billion, the total economic costs over the medium to long term, right? And that was 450,000 like hectares, right? We're now at, as you say, 5, 8, 10. We know it's multiple times bigger now. And so you've got to apply the 4.4 plus inflation, so let's say 6, times 6, you easily get to 36. Yeah, I mean, it's a big number.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's just what is just so interesting and just terrifying about the potential impact on the economy, because it is such an absolutely enormous area. The fires aren't over yet. I mean, we hope and, you know, we pray that somehow, you know, we get rain and that, you know, we avoid the worst of it. But it's already so large.
Yep.
And we just don't know, because Black Friday was in like a relatively small geographical area compared with what we're seeing now. So this is going to have sort of knock-on effects and economic multiplier effects across the country, just, you know, especially in some of these regional centers that have been affected. You know, like they've lost, you know, the main employer, you know, they've lost the tourism, they've lost all these different things. And we don't know how that's going to flow into the regions and surrounding it, and how that's even going to flow into the cities as well, once we sort of start to see the broader economic impact.
Yeah, well, we certainly think it's going to be significant. Now, I guess the last thing I wanted to touch on today was ScoMo's outing yesterday with David Spears, you know, half hour on the ABC. I guess you probably have seen it. What was your reaction?
It was better than what we've seen, which I think is something that's at least a positive step in the right direction.
Hmm.
But he's still really struggling. I think he's put himself in a very, very difficult position where he can't really dig himself out in a hurry. It's going to take something that's going to take time for people's anger and frustration to fade, and for these issues to fade into the background, whether it's as a result of the economy or some other sort of, you know, world events, you know, distracting people from, you know, what's occurred. But I think that relatively speaking, he's actually going to get through this relatively unscathed. You know, I mean, if his personal poor polling continues, then maybe we can look at something. But the thing is, people look at preferred PM like it matters, like it's like this key, absolutely key element of polling, and it's not. You know, like Daniel Andrews was trailing Dennis Knapfine in Victoria in the 2014 Victorian election substantially. You know, he was something like 12 points behind on News Poll in the run up to the election, and which is a much, much greater gap than what Albo has now, and he won, so he had a fantastic victory. You know, John Hewson was in front of Paul Keating, Kim Beazley was in front of John Howard. You know, like I could go on, but I won't. But you know, we could. You know, it's not this measure that really matters. Like, don't get me wrong, it sells papers and it's a fantastic headline and it shows that people are angry. But is it anything that's actually going to really sort of upset Scott Morrison's leadership? I don't really see it at this point. That may change in time as the more polls come in and things may deteriorate or the economy may hit him. We don't know. But for the moment, I think he's actually surprisingly safe.
Do you think he's really held hostage, though, by the right wing of his party in terms of that relatively small number of very vociferous members of parliament who basically are saying nothing to do with climate change, et cetera, et cetera? In other words, is he going to have the same problem as Turnbull had?
I think he will. He most certainly will to a degree. And I think that a lot of these people in these marginal seats, especially down in areas that have been affected by the fires, yes, he's absolutely going to have that problem with a lot of backbenchers saying, come on, ScoMo. You know, we've got to do something here or I'm going to lose my seat. And we don't have a big enough majority for us to be losing these seats. But I think there's also going to be a sense of pragmatism as well this time, because when Turnbull tried to do it, he did it for ideological reasons. He did it because he thought and he believed that that's what the people of this country wanted. But in this instance, there is now, there are now millions of acres of burned land. There's, you know, people suffering from, you know, the smoke blowing into Sydney, smoke blowing into Melbourne. And I think that's going to create at least a little bit more of a fertile ground for Morrison to sort of make some small shifts, some small concessions towards improving the Liberals' climate change policy, but still retaining most of the right wing's sort of, we're not really gonna do a whole lot. We're just gonna do the bare minimum, maybe a little bit more than the bare minimum to satisfy people, but that'll be it.
Right, because he did sort of suggest, I think, in that interview that whilst that target was not going to change in terms of, you know, how much reduction is going to be made, he did rather suggest, I think, that they could potentially not need to rely on those previous transfer credits and basically do a little bit more. So there's a little bit of wriggle room, but my own sense was it was relatively small.
Yeah, but I think the thing is that if he can point to anything, even if it's relatively minor, as saying we are exceeding what we were going to do, he's going to be able to spin that.
Hmm.
And if there's anything that Scott Morrison is good at, it's spinning something minor into something major to make it seem like he's doing a lot. And he's very, very skilled at that. And I think that's something that people really need to understand about where we're at the moment. ScoMo is in a poor place personally, as for his personal rating, but he is a masterful spinner of this type of anything in politics, of spinning all these different things. It's only that he's made absolutely gargantuan screw ups that he's in this mess in the first place. If it was only something relatively minor, the sort of, you know, the media in his favor and all these different things would have sort of come together to protect him, to insulate him. And this is sort of, in terms of events coming together against him, aside from a recession occurring, this is as bad as it gets for him. You know, like, he literally went on holiday in the middle of a bushfire crisis. It's not going to get, he's not going to, unless he's an absolute idiot, which I don't think he is, he's not going to make that level of mistake again. And I think that people need to stop looking at the Liberal Party like they're idiots, because they're not. Yes, they may make mistakes, and yes, they may have, you know, you may be ideologically opposed to them, but it doesn't make them morons, you know? And I think that's something that's really important to remember going forward. Like, lots of people are saying, oh, if we can get rid of ScoMo and we can get in Dutton, there's no way we can lose. It's like, yes, you can. No one thought that ScoMo could win, and here we are.
Yeah, and I think you've made a really interesting point there. And maybe the reason why the titanium shielding is so powerful is because of that fast spinning move that he has, right? It's the combination of that and, you know, the fact that he is actually pretty masterful at being able to take it and spin it and position it. So the marketing skills really come through. And many people don't see beyond that.
No. I mean, you know, a lot of people in my line of work sound like political elitists, because frankly, some of us are. But the reality is that people aren't fully engaged with politics 24/7 like me or you or a lot of other people. You know, yeah. We represent a very small cross-section of the population. And it's all well and good to go on Twitter or Facebook and say, oh, well, I did this poll and 90% of people think ScoMo's useless and he's going to get the bullet. But it's not that simple. You know, we represent a small cross-section of the population, and I think it's important to remember that, you know, 49% of people, even after all of this, would still vote for Scott Morrison over Anthony Albanese. And I think that should be a real lesson to all these people putting out all these different polls and different statistics saying, oh, this number of people, you know, I think it was the Australia Institute came out with a poll the other day that showed that it was overwhelming that Australians wanted climate change action. And okay, but then why is it that when push comes to shove and people are asked about who they're going to vote for in the next federal election, and they turn around and go, don't tell anyone, it's Scott Morrison.
Well, you see, I've got this theory. I've had it for a long time, and I see it in my polls, right? There is a disconnect between people's ideological position as to what, you know, what the country might want to do, but when they actually come to the election, they vote for their own interests, their own self-interests, and frankly, their own hip pocket.
It's human. It's really quite human. I mean, you know, we all say, you know, we have all these lofty ideological ideas, and some of us carry through on them more than others. But by the same token, when someone comes along and says, you know, this is what's going to help you and your family, you're going to go, oh, you know, that's going to sway you pretty substantially, and that's just the way it is, unfortunately. You know, I mean, maybe the world would be better if we sort of looked at things from a more sort of collective perspective. But at the end of the day, this is the democracy we have. And I think that, and I think that's a key point that you made. I think that Labor and the Greens need to start operating within the democracy that we have and not the one that we should. Because it's all well and good to say, oh, but this poll said this about climate change, or this poll said this about this other issue. It's all well and good to say that. We can talk about, like, well, all these different issues where the public overwhelmingly supports action till the cows come home. But at the end of the day, it's about winning elections. You know, I mean, Albo needs to look at Tony Abbott circa 2013 and think, how can I emulate what Tony did to connect with the public? Because Tony's not exactly the, you know, the sort of most sort of connectable, relatable guy in the world. You know, he never has been, but he managed to connect with the Australian people in a way that they understood for their hip pocket. And that's what Albo needs to do.
Yeah. Well, I've always thought that it is ultimately the hip pocket question, which will be the one that will be the winner or the loser here. And then it's worth just reflecting then on incomes flat, cost of living rising, more households under pressure. So there's going to have to be a narrative constructed around helping to find a way out of that hole, if I think whoever is going to win next time.
Absolutely. I mean, if Shorten had have ran on the platform that you just mentioned on wage growth, on improving, you know, getting down the cost of living, improving living standards, all these different things, rather than all these other things that are arguably a little bit more abstract. You know, like, you know, you mentioned franking credits for someone and most people's eyes just glaze over. You know, it's the same thing for a lot of people with negative gearing. They're just like, oh, it helps people buy investment properties. You know, people don't people don't sort of look into these things deeply. So it's about creating a political narrative that resonates, that says you're going to get ahead, because that's what Howard did. You know, how good old, you know, Howard's battlers. And, you know, that's what they really need. The next person who comes into power needs to do if they want to actually change the country.
And see, to me, that's going to be the really interesting question, because there is a lot of, you know, noise and opinion about time to step up to climate change, et cetera, right? But the trouble is about climate change, it's out there. It's, you know, it's a meta problem, whereas the real problems for most people are about income and expenditure. So it'll be an interesting tussle between those two perspectives.
Absolutely. And I think that's one thing that's really important to remember as well, is that if you look at some of these lower socioeconomic areas in Australia, people have been struggling for years.
Yep.
You know, we can talk about the mining boom, we can talk about all these different things, but there are places where food banks have been stretched for years and years, and that's just the reality of the thing. And if you're talking about climate change, if you're talking about all these different things, people may love the idea of fixing it. They may even support fixing it. But if you say to them, this is going to cost you more money, this is going to cost you more in taxes, it becomes a completely different metric. And I think that's something that's really important for Labor and the Greens to remember when they do go to the next election, and they sort of come out and say, oh, how much is the climate policy going to cost? We don't know. That's not what people want to hear. People want to hear answers. You know, and if you can't give someone, you know, in a low socioeconomic area, in a marginal seat, an answer that they can take to the bank, they're not going to vote for you.
Yeah. Well, it's remarkably interesting times, and the power of titanium is once again proven. So very interesting to catch up with you, Tarek. We should do it again sometime soon, because there's plenty to talk about.
Oh, there will certainly be more in the weeks and months to come.
Thanks for your time today. See you soon.
See you soon. Bye.